Okay, this is the March 2nd, 2015 statutory interpretation class. And having now reviewed the latest activities with Yates versus United States and the upcoming King v. Burwell oral argument, we're now delving deeper into the realm of substantive canons of statutory interpretation. Briefly looking back, and again, since we're a little bit behind, I'll just touch on these, but hopefully they'll ring a bell with you. We focused initially on the sort of wrapping up a little bit on the different approaches used in the Alley versus Bureau of Corrections case, where we had Justice Thomas, Justice Kennedy, and Justice Breyer all taking three radically different approaches to interpreting the same text on whether or not the federal government had sovereign immunity against a tort claim from a prisoner who claims that his prayer rug and copy of the Quran was lost. And the bottom line was that the interpretation reached was that the federal government did still enjoy sovereign immunity for that case. But past that, we started talking then about other canons of construction. Just to remind everyone, we talked about wrapping up the grammar canons of construction. Those are the punctuation canons, last antecedent rule, the disjunctive or rule, the permissive may rule, and then really small ones, singular uses of language in plural don't really carry designations. If you use a singular in a language, it usually can be interpreted to apply to multiple, as well as the fact that if you use he, it also covers women as well. And then we had the confusingly named golden rule, which is really just another way of saying the absurd results exception to the plain meaning rule. We talked about the whole act rule. Remember, the whole act rule means that you look at all the language to try and interpret in a way that makes it consistent throughout, but it had some corollary effects. You look at the title of a statute, for example, but the title typically is not given determinative weight. It's an additional indicia of intent. I flagged this one for you because this was a scrapping ground in the Yates case I just described to you, where Justice Ginsburg was the first thing she looked to was the title of the statute to indicate that it was limited only to materials that contain information. Justice Kagan said, foul. You can't look to titles because by definition, titles are a condensation, a synopsis, a summary of what that statute contains, and by definition always will be incomplete and unreliable. So right up front, you can see that this is a canon, this is a particular rule that doesn't carry a uniform weight. And the same principle as well, preambles, that sort of information that Congress dictates, can take some weight, oftentimes though it's not determinative. And provisos, provided that, those provisos are usually interpreted strictly. Usually because you don't want the exception to swallow through the actual overall language. We've already talked about a few of the other last rules before that we were wrapping up. In particular, the rule against surplusage, which has already popped up. We talked about the presumption of consistent use of terms. Well, let me stress that is one that is not terribly strong. The court has been willing to find that the exact same word and the exact same statute can be used with different meanings that binds other indicia that Congress intended it, but your starting point is usually the word has the same meaning. And then we talked about the whole code rule, which is more than the whole act. It means you can range far and free to other statutes Congress has passed on the same general subject matter area, and presume that the term is used consistently, although again, it's only a presumption. Then wrapping up, we talked about the West Virginia University and Casey case, which dealt with to what extent attorney's fees are recoverable. And we looked at a demonstration again as to how the justices used a literalist, straight up textual approach versus a more larger intent-based approach. So with that, taking a deep breath, we're now going to start digging into some of the more important substantive canons. I will tell you right now that these are ones that you will find the most useful in your practice going forward. The grammar canons, the linguistic canons are generally applicable, but the substantive canons are the ones that can win the case for your client if you can deploy them correctly. Any questions looking back on the material I just sort of went through very quickly right now? Bless you. I really missed my opportunity there. Okay, so let's talk about substantive policy canons. And right up, the name tells you immediately the nature of the game has changed. A substantive canon is not neutral. It is a canon that steers the court as an initial position towards a favored outcome. Now, this has evolved. In the past, there were some fairly general substantive canons. One of the most honored ones was the idea that a remedial statute was to be interpreted liberally. Alternatively, statutes that took areas that common law used to govern and turned them into statutes, those statutes were interpreted narrowly. Both of those general rules have kind of fallen by the wayside as history has moved on. I would be welcome anyone who wants to have a cup of coffee to talk about the remedial canon construction, because that actually is having some serious echo effects right now in health, safety, and environmental issues. So, as we moved away from that, we now have more of a list approach. There is not rather than one or two meta principles, we have a sort of subject matter canon approach. Your book sort of lists them all in about 3 pages. What I'd like to do is go over them with you briefly with 2 thoughts. One, it is so easy when you're gunning to get ready for class to pull out your highlighter and go, and please just go right through this really quickly. Don't. These lists of canons actually contain very important principles. In addition, the way the book has listed them makes it hard to see which ones are important. So what I'd like to do is go through them quickly and give you a little bit of the flavor of which ones are actually the ones that are most currently active and important. So with that in mind, let me start with the ones that, and again, this will be a little bit out of order from your book, but bear with me. The ones that I've seen happen most recently, I think you'll find most practitioners have seen pop up most recently, are the presumptions that are towards the end of the substantive canon introduction. So for example, the presumption that Congress does not intend to violate international law when it writes a statute. It sounds fairly abstract, fairly neutral. It's a good starting point because the United States as an international actor is typically viewed to be bound by international law. Congress can violate international law if it chooses, but it triggers international sanctions potentially by doing so. It also undermines the integrity and potency of international law. Well, it has real-world consequences. The case that's listed in the parenthetical, the Sosa versus Alvarez-Machain case, actually was a case dealing with someone who was abducted by agents in Mexico and brought to the United States for interrogation. Was that valid use of American force of law? And the court relied on this presumption to find that that type of activity was not typically deemed to be within the compass of the statute unless the statute clearly said so. Number 2, presumption that we are not going to violate treaty obligations. Also an important one that popped up, particularly with some of the rendition cases. Third, this one's particularly important, presumption that Congress does not intend its laws to apply outside the United States. No extraterritorial application. Again, sounds dry, neutral when you say it in space. But if you see a statute that's written in broad terms that can be applied outside the boundaries of the United States to say, for example, activities by U.S. citizens abroad, or activities by the U.S. military in other countries, it could have enormous consequences. This was a major issue, for example, in a case that was decided by the Supreme Court last year. Very briefly, there's a statute called the Alien Tort Claims Act, which was actually one of the very first statutes passed by Congress, which gives the U.S. District Courts jurisdiction to hear claims for violations of human international law brought by aliens. There is a lot of cases focused on a wide array of human rights violations around the world that attempted to bring those violators to justice before the U.S. District of U.S. court system. For example, there were judgments against persons who had tortured opponents in Latin America. There were cases against the Palestine Liberation Organization for human rights violations due to the campaigns that involved assassination of Mahmoud. All of these cases that went back 30 years
died in a puff of smoke last year when one case brought by activists alleging that there have been human rights violations in Nigeria by goons hired by the national government working on behalf of Shell related to petroleum exploration. The Supreme Court basically said, we're done because of this presumption. We read the Alien Tort Claims Act to only be applied within the United States for activities within the United States, unless Congress spoke clearly otherwise. Because of this presumption, enormous policy consequences flowed. No review of legislative history, no review of the statute's legislative structure, or, statutory structure, just this presumption. Another major important one that I'll flag for you that will almost certainly pop up when you're handling cases is the presumption that laws will not be applied retroactively. This is one of those statutes, one of those presumptions that has some quasi-constitutional roots. Ex post facto liability. For those of you who are, I'm not sure Professor Turner's at the top of this, but for example, the prohibition on bills of attainder. The idea of imposing liability for actions that were legal in the past, but then Congress decides going forward are going to be illegal, you can't reach back in time and impose penalties for that prior legal action. Well, that's only a presumption. Congress does have, subject to this constitutional restriction, the ability to impose liability for past acts, particularly in a civil context. But I will simply tell you, billions of dollars have flowed back and forth based on statutes being read according to this presumption. Next up, very important one, presumption of judicial review. Congress does have the ability to limit the power of district courts to review statutes, subject to some broad constitutional constraints. The courts will take pains to use this presumption to find judicial review unless Congress clearly expressly speaks otherwise. At the same vein, the presumption against derogation of the president's traditional powers is very important for many reasons, not least of which separation of powers concerns and the willingness of the court to try and remove itself from interbranch disputes. Now we're sort of getting to presumptions that are still important, but they tend to have more of a legal arena to them. But I will also tell you, the odds are high you'll have to cross paths with some of these at some point in your careers. The presumption that Congress will not withdraw a court's equitable powers. Again, sounds fairly dry and neutral. What does that mean? It means, can Congress point a finger at the courts and say, you have to issue an injunction to enforce this statute? Can Congress say, you can never issue an injunction to enforce this statute or any other equitable remedy? It pops up in the weirdest places. For example, there was an attempt to enjoin the Navy from doing sonar testing in the Pacific because the allegation was it was killing whales. The Ninth Circuit issued a broad injunction on exactly those grounds. The Supreme Court reversed in NRDC versus Winters on the grounds that there was a presumption that Congress would not have limited the court's abilities to issue this type of equitable relief, but here Congress did speak clearly because it had a national security exemption from the statute that the injunction was issued under. Next up, Congress does not intend the federal regulation to unnecessarily intrude into areas of traditional state authority or responsibility. I'll flag this one for you. It will come up again in a stronger form in our next class, which are canons dealing with federalism. The idea of preservation of state authority to proceed absent federal preemption. Now we're sort of getting to the more cats and dogs. And again, I'm worried my value system, I don't mean that this may be very important to some of you in areas you want to practice in, but I'll tell you, you tend not to see them quite as much in practice. The idea that there's a presumption against diminishment of American Indian rights, very important, but in the fairly narrow arena. The idea that there are strict constructions of statutes that are in derogation of sovereignty. This is the sovereign immunity issue that we talked about, the Holly versus Bureau of Corrections case. Strict constriction of public grants and strict construction of some revenue provisions. And that's it. That's the list. My suggestion is these, I'm not trying to tell you what you need to memorize and what you don't need to memorize, but I will simply tell you that certainly the ones that I listed towards the top of that list are important, even though they get fairly short shrift in the text, and they're worth
devoting a brain cell or two to understanding them and knowing when they pop up, being able to recognize them. So with that, before I start lobbing a few questions to you to help digest these, any questions about that list of canons, presumptions, and constructive rules? Yes? I hate to confess this. I can barely hear you, so you might need to speak a little louder.
So you said like a couple of times, like we presume that they don't intend to do X, Y, or Z unless it's explicitly said in the statute. Is that something that you just kind of add on to the whole thing?
That actually is a very deep question, which, you know, at this point, whenever I say it, most students come with their hands in their head and say, oh, no. But seriously, there is a difference into how these rules get used. And you may have already seen some of these are popping up in your cases already. If you notice that there's sort of a difference in the strength that courts will give to some of these canons of construction. For example, some of them basically just use these presumptions as tiebreakers. You have equally valid interpretations, the court can decide, okay, we'll use this sort of last feather on the scale, the tip of one or the other. Presumptions are stronger. It's not a question of whether or not they're equally strong for a particular side. Presumption says that one of these is going to be our starting point, but you can overcome that presumption just by evidence. Legislative history, other indicia of intent built into the structure of the statute, you have some language choices, but the presumption sort of tells you where you're starting from. So you might be like five steps ahead of the starting point compared to the other. What you're talking about is something that's the strongest version, and I've used that language for some of them, but not all of them, and that's intentional. The clear statement implementation of this simply says, regardless of the degree of evidence supporting each side, the court will not give the interpretation that goes against that preference unless Congress clearly states it. There are some deeply imbued values the courts are going to preserve. So, this clear statement rule is going to come up in particular in our next class. We'll talk about the Gregory versus Ashcroft decision, where it is this idea of federalism is built into a clear statement rule. It's sort of the strongest version of it. That was a very long answer. Did I get what you're asking about there? Any others? All right. So, all right. I have to erase this. I'm sorry, guys. However, if anyone wants to help me plot revenge, let me know if you have any ideas. All right, so I promised a few questions. So let me start with hopefully the question that tickles the back of everyone's minds for reading these lists. Where did this come from? What's the source of law for these presumptions? Why do we pay attention? But this is not for the reading bench. This is a general question for everybody because it's not in your text overtly. But it's a question I'd like you to think about.
Okay. Maybe, you know, after a statute is written, a situation arises where it seems clear that somebody isn't meant to fall into the statute or a certain situation isn't meant to be within the scope of the statute. So they kind of make assumptions back.
Okay, but I guess let me sort of put it in blunter terms. And you're right, to a certain extent, that's how it operates. But I'm asking where do the roots for that presumption come from? Is, for example, the presumption against extraterritorial application a creature of statute? Is it something that's common law? Is it something more than that? Where did it come from? Jordan's giving me this look like, well, I'm not sure. But
some could be the Constitution, some could be common
law. So some of these come from the Constitution, some come from common law? Okay. All right, and those are perfectly valid answers. By the way, guys, I'm not asking you to guess what's in my head. I'm not asking you to guess what's the right answer here because, spoiler alert, there is no clear concise, crisp answer on this. The Supreme Court has never said in black and white terms exactly where these presumptions come from. But I'm asking you to sort of use your native intelligence. I mean, think about this. These canons go back, some of them, to before the United States came into existence. Remember some of the canons of construction we looked at, you know, like the original implementation of the Golden Rule. If these are rooted in things like the Constitution, why are they simply just canons? Why aren't they binding force of law declarations that a state, for example, can't override because of the Federal Supremacy Clause? For those of you looking ahead someday to a note or a seminar paper and you want to talk about this, let me know. But if these are solely creatures of common law, which seems to be the sort of immediately apparent possible answer, does that mean Congress can override them? Can Congress pass a statute saying all courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, must use the following canons of construction in interpreting our statutes? Even overriding canons that have quasi-constitutional grounds. If a state, oh, I'm sorry, Jeff. Why?
Specifically delegated, like the interpretation of the law is specifically delegated to the courts. So it seems to me they use whatever tools they have the power to use when they're going to be hired.
So they have the power from our branch to review, judicially review, that statute when it first comes out. Are you saying then basically that they disregard the statute from Congress telling the courts this is how they intend these statutes to be interpreted when they're created? This is their lexicon. I'm sorry?
I think I
said
three.
Yeah. Hey, and again, guys, no hard answers
to
this.
Can't they just call it by specifically writing language that says this is exactly what we mean? So, because the canons can't overrule the explicit text. So
in theory, you don't need canons if plain meaning is clear.
Yeah.
I would say, from a pure logical perspective, you're dead on right. But it assumes what some might argue is impossible, doesn't it? That you can write plain language in all cases that will cover all contingencies in the future. It can, in a way, you know, Professor Eskridge definitely uses it as an adaptive tool to extend statutes past their original intent to govern unforeseen situations. I'm asking a slightly different question, which is assume Congress knows, they'll write as plain as they can, but it can't cover everything. So they have a clause saying, this statute will be construed liberally, and we will not allow the rule of lenity to be put into effect for this statute. Can they do that? Would the court have to give them power?
I think they could be saying set
the
court's jurisdiction. So,
where, again, now going back to Jeff's point, where does it stop? To a certain extent, now you have Congress dictating how judges think about cases. Yeah. To what extent do the canons reflect a degree of judicial exercise judicial power that can't be overridden, which means they're different than just a common law presumption, which Congress clearly can override when it chooses to. Let me even give one last,
I guess when there's really important practical implications like severance, like telling the court that they can sever something out, like you know, in the Sibelius case, we didn't call law, where they took out one part of it, and they, which meant that they didn't have to gut the whole act because there's so much time went into it that if they had, it would have undone like years of work.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, Sibelius is a fantastic case. I hope you guys had a really spirited discussion about it.
We've had like four.
Four? Well, maybe that's a little bit too much spirit. Yes, you're exactly right. Congress can dictate rules of severability within a statute itself. Can they pass a statute that says, for every other statute from here on out, we want to be them to be severable? The court will take extra pains to preserve the rest of the statute if only one provision of it has to be struck down.
I think that it gets to a point where it kind of doesn't matter if the statute gets, you know, torn apart or whatever, and the entire thing falls apart, but it's something where so much work has gone into it. Mm-hmm. I think that's where they kind of draw the line.
Okay. Then let me offer two quick thoughts, because I do want to make sure we have a little time for our cases today. Number one, it's already happened. Congress has already passed, it's called the Dictionary Act. It's an old statute. I'll put a link up for you, the website for you. But essentially, it dictates how the courts will interpret particular terms. It also dictates some policy judgments into how certain terms are defined. You might be surprised to find, for example, human life is defined in the statute to include unborn citizens. Second, states have done the same. Texas has a Code Construction Act, which has all the canon and substantive judgments we're talking about embodied in black and white. Texas, for example, has expressly said the rule of lenity shall not apply to construction of its criminal statutes. Depending where these canons come from, can a court say, pshaw? The constitutional rights of the defendant are rooted in the Constitution itself. And Congress cannot dictate the way we interpret statutes to preserve those rights in a way that undermines them. That's happened in other states. Texas has some minor examples of that, but it hasn't really had an overt conflict on it, to my knowledge. Last, let me sort of give you the real-world instantiation of this. Diversity. And now I'm probably bringing back horrific, cold sweat nightmares of you for Civ Pro. But remember, diversity, if it's in a federal court, the governing rule of law, going back to our old favorites, Erie Railroad versus Tompkins, state law governs. Substantive state law governs. If a state has a canon of construction that would determine how that statute, the state statute, applied to this diversity case would be interpreted, is a federal court required to use the state canon of construction? Doesn't that answer depend on where these canons come from? So, food for thought. And I'm not trying to torture you, although it is always enormous fun. I'm not trying to give you questions to which there are no answers. There are a lot of people wrestling with answers, and a lot of people believe they have a firm answer to them. I want you to think about them independently, because we'll circle back to them as we talk to these canons. But where these canons come from, are they law? What type of law? They're all really pretty important questions here. So with that, taking a pause before we start diving into the rule of lenity, any questions? Including philosophical meaning of life questions at this point. Okay? All right, so let's deal with our first big substantive canon of construction, the rule of lenity. So let's start by shooting fish in the barrel. What is the rule of lenity? Bless you. You can tell it's spring. I was actually suffering this weekend pretty severely. Chris, why don't we go ahead and start with you. What's the rule of lenity?
Sure. Basically, the statutes is ambiguous, especially in terms of criminal statutes. It can be interpreted different ways. You should always interpret it.
Okay. So I want to make sure, especially if it's criminal, you said? So it can have application to civil statutes?
It could, but especially if it works more heavily in criminal cases.
Okay. Anyone else would care to elaborate or add to Chris's definition? Is that sort of a good working definition to start with? So breaking it down logically, the predicate is if you have a statute, and I might come back to whether or not it's a criminal statute, but let me, if I can, give you a working limitation saying usually criminal. If it's ambiguous, then the rule of lenity says you have to interpret it in favor of the defendant. So you can certainly see then the requirements are you've got to have a criminal statute typically, although Chris is exactly right, some civil statutes that have criminal-like aspects can trigger the rule of lenity, but usually it's criminal. Has ambiguity, then the rule of lenity basically says the defendant's interpretation wins. I'll pause here. If we had more time, I'd love to talk with you a little bit about why we have a rule of lenity. And the text goes through it pretty well. I'll just sort of offer up for you, or just ask real quickly, three reasons why we have a rule of lenity. Make sure we get. I noticed our reading panel is all on this side of the room today, So this is one for the other side of the room, very briefly. What would you offer as a justification for the rule of lenity?
I guess when you're talking about locking people up, you should give them the benefit of the doubt.
Why?
Because
they're criminals.
No, they're not, necessarily. They're not guilty. So I think it's such a serious thing to throw somebody in jail. If there is an ambiguity in the law, it should be resolved in their favor. That's the justification.
Okay. So there's a due process element to it then?
Sure.
Okay. I'm sorry.
How can you expect somebody to adhere to the law when nobody understands the law?
So there.
So,
okay.
So you can't penalize them for that.
So it's a due process with a fair notice element. Quick side point. The idea of fair notice for those who are interested in criminal law is a hugely important issue. It also can play an important role in civil enforcement. I've seen multi-million dollar penalties vanish like dew because the government failed to give proper notice of the nature of the offense required to trigger the liability. And I'm sorry, you had your hand up too. Okay, and then going beyond due process, anything else you can throw onto the table here? Okay, so consistency of the statutory term.
Yeah.
Kind of like that. In a way, of course, it carries forward the idea of coherence of statutes. And I'm sorry.
I think you said that you don't want the judges making common law crimes, you want the crimes to be delegated by the legislator, which is popularly elected.
So that's a separation of powers issue. Side note for those of you tracking, and Ryan, I'll pause for a second. Keep in mind, historically, common law crimes were actually the norm before the United States came into creation. And the death penalty frequently was imposed for laws defined and elaborated by judges. So you can see why there's an important protective value built into that separation of powers analysis here. I'm sorry, Ryan, what were you going to say?
That's lost when it gets to like a mens rea idea, like moral culpability.
And why is that important?
If you want to. It's important because you don't want to lock people up if they're not sure that you'll have that intention, that mens rea idea. It's just because it's a criminal, we're mostly focused on here.
So, putting it into perhaps too simple language, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, we're going to assume Congress only wants to imprison bad people,
that's
malignant harps.
It's like an evil intention, yeah.
And if you can interpret a statute in one way so that it gets after the mens rea, but another way it snares the innocent, going to prefer the one that only gets the guilty. Side note, I'll tell you, people without malignant intent go to jail all the time for different types of regulatory offenses. But that's a soapbox for not another time. Okay, so these are great listings here. Before we move on, then, any others you want to add that we feel like important ones we might miss? Make sure we're doing justice to everybody in the room. Okay? So with that in mind, then let's talk about our case today. This is our primary case. I'm not sure, we may end up pushing a little bit, particularly the Skilling versus US case to the beginning of next class, which I don't want to let that one go entirely simply because it has such deep history and roots in Houston. But having said that, Muscarello. And with that, Chris, you did a great job earlier. Can you start by telling us what were the facts of Muscarello and what was the legal issue? Okay.
And so he's trying to argue that having a gun inside of like a car or a vehicle compartment that's locked, it doesn't constitute carrying. So he shouldn't be sentenced to the mandatory 5 years.
Okay.
That's basically
that. And you've distilled it down to its logical premise flawlessly. As always, though, I would like to go back and get a little bit of the flavor if we can.
Sure.
The facts. When you say he's a drug trafficker, which, you know, I get a picture of Al Pacino behind a desk with a mound of white powder in front of him. What was Muscarello doing?
I think it was just marijuana, or something trivial.
I like just marijuana. Okay. And so, was he staying in a street corner and holding people up with his gun to sell his marijuana, or what was going on?
He was just, he was transporting his cars.
I think it's pickup, but if you want to get a Texas flavor here, let's keep going.
And then I think that's all he was doing. And he has a car, he had a gun locked up in his car.
So the gun was in his car. Where was it in his car?
It was in a locked up compartment.
So the glove compartment?
No, it's a, it's locked up in one of the guard compartments.
Okay. So basically he had, let's assume, a handgun inside the glove box, locked in his car, while he was driving to sell marijuana. And by the way, I'm trying not to proselytize here. You know, I do sort of feel a little bit for Muscarello. I will point out he wasn't carrying a small little bag. He was carrying 3.5 kilos of marijuana. So he wasn't a Boy Scout. I will. And hopefully none of you in the room are going, well, that sounds about right. But anyway. All right, so what you said is that there's a particular statutory provision in that said he automatically goes to jail for 5 years. And what was the language specifically there?
So it says, whoever during and in relation to any crime of violence or drug trafficking crime uses or carries a firearm shall, in addition to the punishment provided for such crime or violence or drug trafficking crime, be sentenced to imprisonment of 5 years.
So, teasing out the words you were reading there, uses or carries a firearm, is that right?
Yes.
And it has to be in relation to?
In relation to.
So during and in relation. Another shorthand here, crime. And the crimes here typically are crimes of violence or drug trafficking crimes. So it's not all crimes, it's a very narrow subfragment. All right, so that sets the stage. What's the outcome? As always, my favorite question, who won?
So in a lawsuit in this case, the court kind of interpreted carrying a really broader way than the defendant wanted to. So that includes carrying in a vehicle. So having a gun in a vehicle constitutes carrying according to the majority.
All right, so if I could whittle it down even further than the government won.
Yes.
Muscarello goes to jail. 5 years hard time felony conviction for having a gun in his glove box. And again, I'm not tipping my hand as to whether this is right or wrong, but I've captured what could be viewed as some fairly harsh consequences here. All right? So, Justice Breyer wrote the majority opinion. What was the, you know, again, this class always operates on two levels. There's the substantive, and there's also the how. So how did Justice Breyer come to the conclusion that this language here mandated Muscarello going to jail?
So I think the first thing that Justice looked at was look at dictionaries. So always look at dictionaries, look at multiple dictionaries, finding the terms. And then,
if I could add a layer, the dictionary is relevant because it helps block out the plain meaning, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Look at the plain meaning first. That's what from dictionary, so basically two terms. One is carry firearms, which is like in a wagon, a car, vehicle, which they conclude that was the right one. Or the second one, more narrow one, is like packing a gun or a personal possession of a gun. That's the second thing.
Okay. Anything else besides dictionaries?
They look at online database, also look at the Bible, and.
I'm sorry, look at what?
The Bible.
The Bible?
Yeah, like how creative writers wrote over historical writings. The word carrying.
So Justice Breyer is using the Bible as a work of literature, I'm assuming.
Yes,
there's no divine meaning to the word used to carry.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so literature. It was, if I remember right, a New York Times database. So basically press reports. And you also said cart. All right. I assume you're talking about the roots of the word itself, linguistically. So I have to say, just I can't resist because it's such a rare beast. It's one of those cases where etymology, the actual root derivation of the word is invoked as what the meaning of the word is. So we're going back to Old English, sometimes Greek. All right, and together they all said the same thing?
Yes. Yeah, well, it says differently, but the way that a majority of Canada phrases says the majority of claiming is what they meant. Like, most of the one third of the court, most of them is what they meant.
Does Justice Breyer say that carry, as interpreted here in these sources, has only one meaning?
It has multiple meanings.
Okay.
And because it has multiple meanings, I'm like saying that. Nate looks at the legislative intent and says, according to legislative intent, they don't want to limit the definition to just packing a gun.
Okay, so multiple meanings, but the legislature. I'm sorry, the legislature meant all the meanings to apply?
Yeah, or their intent. Their intention was to start, like, looking at their intent, they want a broad interpretation, not just the one, just the limited form that the defendants are arguing for.
Okay. And so, since then, carry could be interpreted broadly to include both pack and keep, but also putting it into a horse-drawn cart. Congress intervened broadly. Okay? And at this point, we start devolving into possible hypothetical scenarios where ridiculous outcomes can come about. But, like, for example, if I pack my sawed-off shotgun in my suitcase and fly to Europe to do my major drug transaction in Marseille, would this fly?
I don't know, probably. If you're interpreting it in a wrong way.
Okay, but Justice Breyer was faced with that particular question, wasn't he? Did he say
it's it? It's not in relation to the actual drug, the drug trafficking, so it doesn't apply.
So if I put my suitcase and fly to Marseille, I'm okay. If I take that suitcase and carry it with me to the transaction, I'm doing 5 years hard time.
Yes.
So carries has different contexts in that. Okay.
If that broad meaning of carries covers virtually everything, including horse-drawn carts, what's left of uses?
So I think they define uses by in another case talking about active employment. So I think that's what they define that as. So carries is more like a not active employment of the gun. Active employment or carrying a gun.
Right. In the prior case, you're thinking about some fascinating case where someone traded their gun for drugs, which makes they must have been really desperate. All right. But is that using the gun as part of the drug transaction?
They said it was trading.
I thought they said it didn't because they had a narrow interpretation of use. I'm not contradicting them, but.
Maybe I read it wrong. Sorry.
No, that's all right. That maybe I read it wrong, which is always a possibility. And actually, we have the advantage of multiple minds here. Hina,
I think that in the past case, the court used the word they interpreted it narrowly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the dissent is saying, why can't the word carry be interpreted narrowly as well?
And did Justice Breyer have a riposte for that? So, isn't that kind of a weird situation? This is interpreted narrowly. This is interpreted broadly. And the argument is since they can cover potentially different things using totally different schools of interpretive thoughts, fine. And you don't have to agree with me. You may notice I'm raising a skeptical eyebrow at this proposition, but okay. All right. So, given that, essentially then, Justice Breyer says, carries can be interpreted broadly to cover poor Muscarella, or hapless pot dealer with the gun inside the locked glove box. Now, I will point out, it's easy to overlook, Muscarella is not the only person involved here. This may have colored the rationale of the case. The other defendant this case was consolidated with, drug gang, they actually had semi-automatic weapons in the trunk of their car driving to a drug transaction. Their argument was, well, it was in the trunk. You can see how that might color your interpretation a little bit to be unfortunately paired with this defendant next to you in the docket.
All right, that's Justice Breyer, but it wasn't unanimous. What about the dissent?
Basically, your dissent says that dictionaries and the Bible and news sources should be used to determine who is a
judiciary. I'm sorry, should or should not?
Should not.
Okay. Can I just a couple of quick things? Notice who wrote the dissent. Ginsburg, with her close, deep friends. Yes, it's a very odd lineup of justices here. I flag this for you simply because Justice Ginsburg wrote the Yates opinion we talked about at the start of class, where she uses exactly the things she's dismissing here, dictionaries, other types of secondary sources. But boy, she takes the wood to them on this one, doesn't she? Highly selective use of a hydra-headed word, ouch. All right, but beyond being ad hominem, what else does Justice Ginsburg have to say?
She said that basically the Constitution and Black's Law Dictionary indicate that the word carry does refer to on the person.
Mm-hmm.
She says that because the majority used evidence that more than a third of the sentences found from the New York Times database and the U.S. News database, that basically, the majority said that a third of the sentences that they found were consistent with the majority's interpretation of the word carry. Mm-hmm. And so the dissent is saying, well, what about the other two-thirds of uses?
So essentially, Justice Ginsburg is saying carry can have multiple meanings.
Right.
I don't think Justice Breyer would disagree with her. I mean, Chris was saying Justice Breyer conceded up front carry can have multiple meanings. Okay, so why?
She says that the word varies should be interpreted with considering the rule of lenity.
Mm-hmm.
She says that because of the seriousness of having a criminal conviction and how it gains the moral condemnation of the community, legislatures and the courts should not basically
Marvel separation of powers concern, everyone here lined out nicely. So basically, if I'm doing justice to Justice Ginsburg, to say her red analysis consists of saying dictionaries, newspapers, what matters is this is a word that has two meanings. Its plain meaning, by definition, is not unambiguous. And therefore, since it is logically conceptually subjectable to two different meanings, the rule of lenity should apply because we're dealing with someone's life. The liberty values here are paramount. Okay? Chris, you've been channeling Justice Breyer so nicely today. What did Justice Breyer say about the rule of lenity, though?
She says it doesn't apply because the language isn't. And that's just because the legislature went to them so clear that it's supposed to ambiguous what they want. So you shouldn't apply the rule.
So ambiguity is in the eyes of the beholder here. I'll pause here. You did a wonderful job defining the rule of lenity to start the class. Remember the elements required. You had to have a statute, presumably, typically criminal, that contained an ambiguity. Here, what constitutes a sufficient level of ambiguity is the real source of dispute between the majority and the dissent.
Justice Breyer admits there's ambiguity, but it's not enough to keep them from defining clearly and unambiguously what Congress meant in deploying this multi-meaning word. Justice Ginsburg says no, that what we have here is a word that has multiple meanings. The very fact that there is a deep 5-4 split in the court indicates there's sufficient ambiguity to trigger the rule of lenity. You'll find that oftentimes that's the dance. The rule of lenity, but also old code construction, the rule against absurd results, and justum generis. You know, going back to the bottom line here is a justice will frequently concede that the rule would affect the outcome of the case, but then find a reason to deny the application of the rule. Remember, Remember the prior opinion where adjustum generis, where we had a list of conditions, but then Justice Thomas said, it doesn't apply because what we have really is one thing and then a catch-all phrase rather than a list and a catch-all phrase. Therefore, adjustum doesn't apply. That sort of gambit gets played out fairly often. So I'll pause here. Any questions so far on the rule of lenity about this case, about canons of construction, particularly substantive ones? Because what I'd like to do is save, and David, you've been enormously patient. I may ask you to be our leadoff hitter for our next class. But we'll pick up McNally and Skilling fairly briefly to start our next class. But then we'll dive into two of the more important canons, the kind of constitutional avoidance, the idea you try to interpret a statute to keep it from creating a constitutional conflict, and the cousin, which is the canon on federalism. Interpret a statute in a way so that it can avoid impinging on key aspects of the sovereignty of states. That's the Gregory versus Ashcroft case, which is one of those ones you probably need to know by name, so it's worth paying a little attention to. Heads up, I tried to avoid this, but this is one of those readings which is a little bit longer than other days, so you might give yourself a little bit of a head start on this one. If you wait till the morning of, you will find yourself gasping for breath by the time you get to class. Last chance. Any other questions, thoughts, suggestions, ideas? All right, if you have a chance as well, we'll talk a little bit at the end of class about the Supreme Court argument on the healthcare case, which should be fun. And with that, enjoy the week. See everyone on Wednesday. Oh, I'm sorry, one last announcement. I will not be in my office hours tomorrow. I've been asked to participate in a conference. I'll try and get back, but I wouldn't be here until the earliest 3:30 or 4 o'clock. If you want to visit with me tomorrow, give me an email and a heads up, and I'll try and get back here in time for you. But alternatively, I'll be glad to schedule time on Thursday or Friday instead. So with that, have a great day, for real this time.